we're looking for on VaynerMedia or my team, people that are creators, video and picture people, designers and animators or creators or illustrators or whatever you are. Do you make pictures and videos and write words and come up with ideas for things that sell? We're looking for creators that are less about brand, but more about selling DNA. So if I had to sell wine or sneakers, get it now? Or for clients, if they needed a conversion, have you done creative copy or design or video for conversion-based activities? People that have actually bought something, not awareness, not brand, sales DNA in your creativity. If you have, there's a link in my profile now. Profile now. So you can join our team. Hope to see you in the halls, at least the virtual halls, soon.
This is the Gary V Audio Experience.
Super excited for another episode of Coffee and Commerce. I'm here with my far more handsome partner in crime, Zubeen. And we have a pretty epic guest with us this week, a gentleman that I've admired from far, so I'm excited that I get to jam with him a little bit here. Admire because I think it comes from a good place. I'll let him get into it. And I'm just, big shout out to everybody who's watching right now. I'm gonna go into Manning Social here a little bit to build up some hype and get everybody listening, because I think we're gonna have a remarkable show. So Jason, first of all, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Zubeen, why don't you create the context for the audience a little bit about Jason, and we'll let him talk a little bit about it. Then we'll get into the Q&A, and I will start to play my color commentary that I like to do in these episodes.
Let's do it. I love it. Yeah, Jason, great to have you on. Just for the audience, to give you some context, the stuff that we talk about often has to do with one aspect of e-commerce or another, but what we're really focused on is e-com holistically, direct-to-consumer holistically, and how to build companies, how to build brands. And I think Jason is really a special individual as it comes to that, because he's gone and done so much. So I'll let Jason tell you about his past, his story, but it's been around starting a hedge fund, building that, going through some things personally that I'd love for you to talk about, Jason, and then where he is now in terms of founding and being the CEO of HumanCo. Just a fascinating story. And Jason, why don't you tell us the story and we'll jump in.
Sure. So I started in the hedge fund business in 1998. Actually, as a quantitative analyst, and I was a quant for my first 5 years. Then I morphed more into a fundamental portfolio manager and investor, which I then did up until the end of 18, early 19. I worked at three firms where I had some terrific mentors in public investing. Most of my focus in public investing was on long short equity with a quantitative backbone. But, you know, I think someone has a child.
It's Jewish holiday life in here. All the nieces and nephews.
My kids are over there.
I'm you. Go ahead.
A little more quiet. How I got introduced or drawn into consumer products really is a more of a personal story. When I started in the hedge fund world about a year and a half in, I was, you know, working 16, 18 hours a day, doing what kind of young people in New York City tend to do. And I got very sick. I was ultimately diagnosed at the age of 23 with a variety of autoimmune diseases. One of which they told me I was going blind, and that I would be blind by the age of 30.
Jason, on that front, yeah. You know, because this actually could be the biggest impact we have in this episode. And this is kind of what the reference for everybody's watching, kind of what I said in my admiration, because I really admire taking adversity and understanding it and then building on top of it. And from at least from afar, and I don't have every T and I crossed on you, like none of us do about each other, but I really appreciate where you're about to take this. But before, especially in case I bail before this time runs out, you having those issues.
Yeah.
For my own knowledge, to be frank, you know, my brother has Crohn's disease. And my brother left VaynerMedia, you know, kind of abruptly for similar reasons, which was like, but he wasn't actually working. Like, hedge fund land. He just, it was the stress of doing something he didn't like enough that kind of made him go there.
Yep.
But the extreme of like you at that young of an age having those things happen for my own education, because I worked a lot of hours too in my youth and things of that nature. Was that DNA that was inevitable in any way? Was that DNA that was sitting there inside of you that got triggered by some of this? How much of that was mental from the standpoint of less about the actual physical exhaustion, but you yourself were in a place in your life at that time where you were beating yourself up so much. It was an unhealthy ambition.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Help me break that down, because one thing I fear, like finding the juxtaposition between, you know, I used to, 10 years ago, I used to use the word hustle. Now I don't, because it's been manipulated into a world that does have a negative connotation around it being mental burnout. So now I just use work ethic, but I still believe in it. And what I fear is, not what I fear, what I'm trying to figure out all the time is, how do we find the right balance between, hey, work ethic is a requirement to have success, because otherwise you get into delusion and entitlement and the secret and all sorts of other bad stuff, and burning out to like exhaustion and like mental, you know, upsetness is completely unacceptable. But I always try to figure out two things. One, how much was that in you from a chemical standpoint? And yeah, how much were you unhealthy with your ambition because you lacked the patience and you wanted the Wall Street things that came along with it? Like, yeah, who were you at that point as a man? Because I think what I've noticed is a lot of people are getting confused at a young age of like, should I work a lot? Should I work a little? Like, and so I think the, and I appreciate your energy right now, because I think the clarity underneath there really, really matters, because it can really help someone. Because someone could be comfortable with work ethic because they're happy and they don't need a Mercedes, or in reverse. Yeah. You see where I'm going, brother?
Totally, totally. Yeah. It's a great question.
And, thank you.
And you know, I it's a combination to answer the question. You know, I've had my DNA sequenced a few times now in the last 4 or 5 years. They've actually, it's gotten to a place where they can give you sort of some reliable feedback on some of your predispositions and some of the things that you you might be prone to. You know, I'm a big believer in epigenetics, which is this concept of, it's a combination of nature and nurture in terms of what actually manifests. You know, I think for me, what was really difficult was, you know, I was a chronic underachiever up until like mid high school. And just,
do you think, real quick, do you think that that was in hindsight a huge advantage in your life?
Yeah, I think the transition from going from huge underachiever to overachiever in college was something that was pretty remarkable for me.
Are you talking in the macro, or are you talking academically?
I'm talking kind of broad. I mean, all of it, because I, you know, I was one of those kids, and most people who know me today who didn't know me as a child don't believe any of this, but anyone who grew up with me will confirm this. So I was one of those kids who never did his homework, played a lot with video games, weapons, explosives, chemistry kits. I was that kid that a lot of parents told their kids that they couldn't play with because I was a bad influence.
By the way, on the record, I had that too. I wasn't explosive or disruptive, and I don't know if you were disrespectful or any of those other variables. I was just such an atrocious student that parents were scared their kids would get bad grades.
Yeah. I, you know, it's funny because I didn't, most aspects of school I didn't like. And I've always had ADD, and I didn't really know how to channel it. But a few people sort of noticed my precociousness in a few areas that I did like. And then I had a couple teachers in high school who just took me under their wing, and they really taught me how to sort of get my shit together. And then I miraculously got into Penn, which today,
because I went to Mount Ida College with my shit school. So like the Penn thing's confusing. Did you crush junior and senior year and SATs and it was just momentum? Was it like a great uncle like built a gym at Penn? Like what happens there?
Yeah, I think it was a combo of a bunch of things. I was very well-rounded. I was the captain of my tennis team. Okay. I was sort of a quasi-athletic recruiter.
By the way, my business partner in the VaynerX world, Ryan Harwood, who runs our publishing side, who's a dean in Robin, you know,
he went to Penn, and I fully know it's because of tennis.
Yeah. And you know, I played 4 years of college squash when I got there,
what years were you there?
I was 90. I graduated in 1998.
Okay, so you're my age, so you're older than, so you don't know Ryan. Okay, keep going. Yeah.
But what happened was, I was into life hacking and self hacking before it was like a phrase. And I started teaching myself how to become really efficient in college because I had to balance my athletic schedule with my academic schedule. And I started doing really well early. And I was able to sort of recreate my identity from being this underachiever in high school to now being this sort of like achiever. And then what happened was I was raised, you know, in a way that was always about overachievement, even though I didn't really do it. And I started to see that when I applied myself in college, the results were coming. And I effectively created this positive feedback loop that ultimately led to what, you know, my various psychiatrists called a God complex, where I ultimately believed the harder I worked, the better my results would be at the expense of everything else in my life. And
were you happy? Were you a happy person?
I think initially I was happy, but then what happened was,
One other thing. What about outside affirmation in the form of human judgment? Did people's opinions have weight with you?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I was a second child. I definitely cared a lot about what people thought of me. I think I was motivated at that time, to succeed financially.
As a proxy to show that you like to.
Yeah, as a proxy for sort of validation and success.
This is like the thing that I'm will forever be passionate about. I wish. You may know this. I have no idea how much context you have on me. I spend an ungodly amount of effort trying to get people to understand the victory that is loving your game more than what comes with it, so you can use it for validation.
Right.
Like I literally saw a garage sale sign this morning, Josh. I swear to you, this is real. Did Good Morning America, jump in a car, literally did Good Morning America 15 minutes, which is really neat for my mom and this and that, like all that stuff. Drive to my parents here for the Jewish holiday, which is why I'm gonna bounce a little early. Happy New Year to all.
Me too.
Happy New Year, brother. Literally saw a garage sale sign and one of the turns I made going in my parents' like kind of area off the highway and got more chemical juice hype of the potential of maybe tomorrow morning I'll wear a mask and go and look through somebody's trash than everything that was associated with Good Morning America today.
Right.
Process over the, and it hit me. I thought of it. I was like, man, if these fucking people actually knew that what I just said was true, fully true, that the game of waking up at 6 a.m., having a coffee, going there and trying to find a $13 item on eBay for 50 cents gives me more.
Yeah. More. I've always been that way. Like everything interests me. And what happened was, Gary, was everything I started applying myself to and learning all these life hacks kept working. And I went from, you know, I don't even think I was top 50 in my high school class. And I graduated number 3 in Wharton, which is the top school in the country. And all of that was just from application. And I did that at the same time as being a walk-on to the squash team and ended up being an All-Ivy and All-American. And so I developed this loop of like everything I applied myself to just kept working. And so when I ended up getting into the working environment and I thought, oh, I can apply the same kind of approach to working and I'll make a lot more money and I'll move up the ladder and all this stuff. And within a year and a half, I achieved financial success that I didn't think I would achieve for a decade. And yet I started getting very sick. And I started wondering like, wow, I'm depressed. I look like shit. I feel like shit. I'm losing my vision.
Do you think, you know, I stopped rooting for the Yankees and the Rangers when they won their championships. Literally cold. Yeah. Never watched another real game. Do you think there is any chance that when you establish, Jason, that kind of financial success, that because you got there, it triggered the momentum of like, fuck, like I'm here. This sucks. Like, do you think, like, back to process, do you think there was-
Well, I think what happened to me was, and it wasn't just about financial success. I just, you know, you can, when one of the myths of work hard, play hard is sort of not taking care of things that you can't quantify. And so when I got into this mode of learning how to speed read, learning how to shortcut sleep, you know, I basically eliminated exercise. I eliminated my friends. I eliminated things that I thought were unnecessary to my goals.
You became infatuated with these new things that nobody else understood and you took for granted tried and true.
Yeah, and I thought I could will myself to like greatness, and I had a completely misperception of what greatness was. And I also excluded all the things that I think make people healthy. And so I had a totally warped perception of being an overachiever, and I suffered. And I later learned that my physiology and my DNA, and I have a couple polymorphisms, which is kind of a euphemism for, you know, mutations in your DNA. I have a couple polymorphisms that make me prone to not detoxifying properly, which ultimately drives my autoimmune issues and ultimately drove my my degenerative corneal disease. And I had to sort of go through a lot of therapy. I had to do a lot of self-discovery about what I really was trying to do. And it was all at the age of 23, 24, and I'm kind of actually grateful that I got so sick when I did, because I think it ultimately made me more of a balanced person. I think it ultimately made me a better person. And it ultimately, I think, made me more successful, because I think I actually would have probably died if I just stayed on that course without, you know, pausing and recognizing that balance is an essential element to success. So anyway, along those lines, I became, after I cured myself, or technically in remission, but I became fascinated by, because my issue is what I put in my body and on my body, primarily food, beverage, things like personal care, lotion, shampoos, toothpaste, et cetera. And I became an expert, because I had to, on all adulterants that go into products. And everything that we as people take for granted, we assume that when we buy stuff that we put in or on our body, we assume that the people making it have our best interest in mind. And they generally don't. And most of what modern humans consume have different levels of toxicity.
Do you believe that people think that those companies have their best interest in mind, or do you think that people don't actually think about it at all in the scheme of things?
The latter.
Yeah,
I think
right?
Most of the latter.
Right? Like, I don't think people walking around be like, fucking Kraft got my best, right? To your point.
No, it's the latter.
There's no acute impact for it.
But Gary, what I find remarkable is that most people that I deal with in finance and in private equity, and certainly most people who are listening to this call right now, they're probably very diligent people who, you know, take a lot of things seriously in their life. They take their job seriously. But it's amazing to me how most of those people who are disciplined and diligent in most aspects of their life will walk outside, pre-COVID, of course, will walk outside, go to a food truck, ask the guy for a sandwich, presume that it's clean, not know if the guy's an ex-convict and just, you know, adulterated the sandwich, not know what's in it, not ask any questions. And we just presume that when we're putting things on or in our body, that like, it's fine. And it's amazing to me that we don't have more paranoia and vigilance.
We presume everything. We presume there's macro things going on in society, politically, in our country, and everywhere. Like, the human's great vulnerability has been historically assumption.
Yes. So
I agree with you. Like, you know,
so I went on this path, you know, it originally started kind of philanthropically and just as a mission and a passion to look for companies that cared about people over profits, that actually had a mission for providing better for you, cleaner stuff, and actually had some evidence behind what they put in their stuff and without shortcuts. And my brother-in-law, Jordan Brown, my wife, who's his sister, and I, we started a company called Hue. I have the chocolate bar right here, actually. We started a restaurant.
Holy crap. Hold on. This is major. This is a major moment. Please bring that back up. So you have a cashew butter one, right?
Yeah, this is the cashew butter raspberry.
Oh, that wasn't as fun as it could have been because I didn't see the small print. I have like 11 of those in my cabinet and I'm obsessed with it and had literally no fucking idea. This is like the connection point. So I'm super
pumped.
You got to understand this.
I eat these as a snack while I'm just hanging out.
You're about to learn something about me. I'm like the most detailed and the most aloof in this. Like I feel like I'm just like, I'm a weird character of like knowing that much about your macro. And obviously the guys are working with you at VaynerCommerce. And I swear to God, I have 11 of those. 11 of those, not here at my parents. I'm gonna grab, I'm so fucking pissed that I'm not in my apartment right now because I'm gonna grab them and show you. They're fucking amazing.
Thank you.
Here's another one. I had no idea they were that good for me.
Yeah, well, the original genesis of Hugh was that we felt like people don't eat like humans anymore. And that a lot of the modern problems, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, stress, there's a lot of correlation between mood, depression, and your microbiome and what you're putting in your body. But the original genesis behind Hugh was we wanted to have a place where you could trust everything that was in it. And it just started kind of as a passion. It wasn't really meant to become what it is. And then the chocolate and the products started taking off. And while I was doing my day job as a hedge fund portfolio manager, and when we started Hugh, it was like the perfect wrong timing for me because we started Hugh the same month that I launched my own hedge fund. It was like just kind of a weird coincidence.
Hey, Zubin, real quick.
What did you say?
I feel like I'm talking to Zubin. I think I've completely side railed this thing because I'm just interested in your energy.
It's amazing.
We are supposed to talk a little bit about commerce here, right?
We'll get there.
I'm reading the comments and one guy's very upset with me.
No, we'll get to him. Okay. Don't worry about it. Keep going.
All right. I got to leave in 2 minutes anyway. So everybody who's watching, I'm sorry. I'm just enjoying this. And the chocolate thing got me hyped. And I love this guy's macro because I think, to your point, Jason, I think so much of what I'm blessed for and I'm knocking on wood is macro. In the same way that you talk about what people put in their body, I am flabbergasted by people's inability to understand you find what you're looking for in life.
Yeah.
Like perspective is literally like the sadness I see when I see cynicism because it's a choice. You know, what I'm so happy about is that you and many others have created enormous momentum over the last decade around what we're putting in our bodies. I think I'm ahead on what's going on up here.
Yeah.
I really do. I think the things that people view me as like too fluffy for, kindness, karma, you know, I'm a motivational speaker, even though I build all these fucking businesses in everybody's face. Like when they try to razz me, they don't understand. It's practical.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, a lot of the genesis behind this and this was the predecessor to what I'm doing now with HumanCo, but I went a decade trying to find things that I could safely consume that didn't aggravate my own conditions. And I lost trust and faith in most of the products that were out there. And when I found healthy products, and it's not just food, like I needed to do this with things like toothpaste and shampoo. And when I found healthy products, most of the time,
Jason, do you consider this clean? Is that the right word now?
This is a very clean label. And
is that the next step? I know I'm getting ridiculous, Zubin, but I'm having fun. Like it feels like clean is the next step of like people started understanding how to be more thoughtful with calories. But it feels like clean is really like what you're talking about. And by the way, I've stumbled a little bit more, hence why I have these fucking things in my house. I've gotten way more clean and I'm pretty excited about it. I think there's some logic to it.
Yeah, look, there's a lot of logic to it. And there's a reason why it's the fastest growing segment of food is because for a lot of people, they feel better. Even if they didn't have the conditions that I have, for a lot of people, you look better, you sleep better, you feel better. You don't have to count calories. That's a complete myth. Except if you're consuming like 5,000-6,000 calories and stuff. The problem that I wanted to address as an entrepreneur was most of the healthy stuff that was out there tasted like shit. And I felt like I was sacrificing every time I wanted healthy stuff. And then there was stuff that sort of masqueraded as healthy that tasted great, but it really wasn't healthy.
I mean, that's the dominant force today, yeah. Right? Like people that got smarter and you think you're eating a bar that's good and you're like, wait a minute, this is worse than a Snickers or at least equal. Which by the way, me as the entrepreneur and marketer, I'm like, ooh, kudos to you guys. That like fucking worked. Like you definitely made me think, you know, but the math doesn't play out.
Right. So my brother-in-law and I and my wife, we just wanted to make epic shit. And we had very strict guardrails about what we could use as ingredients and how we made it. And we wouldn't release anything that we didn't think was epic. And it shocks me how many things out there are mediocre, like to most people, and they still get released. Like we, you know, and I take kind of a Steve Jobsian approach to this, where I want stuff that I want to binge on, and I want stuff that I think is epic. And if it's not epic, I'm not going to do it. And
on your subjective opinion, which is what's going to lead to some failures, which is
many failures. Hard, yeah, many. Correct.
And I'm going to go back to something. I'm going to get out of here because kids are screaming and I'm ruining this show, which is what goes back to the beginning of mediocrity in the beginning. Your capacity for that is going to be high. I love this balance between deep fucking conviction and wild humility. I've been thinking about this a ton. Like, I literally think that I could be the greatest of all time and equally know I mean nothing. And I deploy that in execution a lot. And I'm trying to understand it. And I see it here and I see it in other things. And it's the most obvious thing I fucking see.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
And it's never talked about. I never hear any, because if you talk about deep fucking conviction, you're an egomaniac. If you talk about humility, it's like people are like, Gary, you can't be kind. You get walked all over and take advantage of. I'm like, no, you don't. I never get taken advantage of.
Yeah.
You're manipulating people and using that as a fake move, or like that's not true. Kindness is a strength.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think you can do great stuff if you don't recognize quickly when you're wrong. You can't change your opinion like that. And you know, I have the same view. Like there's certain things I'm wildly confident in my ability to do. I'm also very capable of admitting I'm wrong within seconds and changing my course immediately.
I do it all the time.
I think it's the most important success in life, attribute to success in life.
Zubin, since we haven't let you talk a whole lot, like on that, because you've gotten very under the hood with me, and don't fucking make me feel good. I just know how I operate as somebody who can co-sign to that. Has that been surprising to you with somebody that has as much conviction of like me changing minds in meetings?
I think one thing about you that's quite interesting, as you mentioned, is like you've got a conviction. So we're going to meetings sometimes and you're set on what you think the right path is, right?
Yeah, I'll even tell you beforehand. I'm like, we're going into this.
Yeah,
we're going
into
this. Yeah.
But if presented the right case and information, et cetera, you'll turn on a dime.
And that's what you're talking about, Jason.
Yeah.
I believe in that shit. I don't know.
Intellectual honesty, ability to
but that is the balance of humility and conviction and self-awareness and understanding so that you're actually, because what's the intention? Both of you have intentions to do good, move things forward. And so you rely on your conviction to be able to do that, but you don't heavily rely on it where it becomes a fault.
Because I play in a game of merit. Ultimately, it's going to play out and everyone's going to see the score. So why be delusional all the way through? I'm not tricking people. Like it's going to, their facts matter. Like your decision was wrong. You have to then own it. You can't like, I'm not going to be a revisionist in history.
I know this show's about Jason, but just one more thing about you, Gary, it's because you want to win. You don't want to be right.
Correct. And I want to win in a way that feels nice for everybody associated with it. I want to win on a team.
Yeah.
I'm not a golfer or a boxer. This is why I like football, 53 fuckers. I love team. I love that feeling. I might want to be a captain. Jason, when you hear that, back to squash, tennis, does that resonate? Like,
yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, a lot of my success has come from who I've hired and who's been part of my team. And I've never had an ego about it has to be the me show. You know, I've always looked for who are people that complement my strengths and help my weaknesses. And I've deliberately assembled teams around me to, you know, with specifically, I've always had a few people on my team who tell me no, who tell me the emperor's wearing no clothes, and who call bullshit. And
Jason, I think real quick, last thing, because I bounce, because you, I like bantering with you, and we may have to do this again on my podcast, because I see something here where we can get, because here we are again. How many times in your career have you seen somebody who figured out in different places, not in your cocoon, that being the person that calls bullshit has some political clout, and they actually call bullshit when they don't fully believe it, and they don't realize that you get it, and that they're act like there's the people that you just talked about that you value tremendously. Have you come across, because I'm trying to help people that are listening that maybe are early in their process, have you come across the individuals who think that's like a smart move, but then when poked and prodded, don't have the meat behind that? Yeah, it's,
yeah, like, definitely.
It's like the strategic naysayer that sees that they're around a leader that has a lot of juice and is often correct, so they try to sneak in and think that's a move, but in reality it ultimately exposes them. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it typically is the insecure folks, because they want to appear like they're adding value, and by being a naysayer, it appears that they're being thoughtful and adding value, when sometimes it's actually just not necessary.
Or ultimately they get exposed for being uncomfortably wrong.
Right.
All right, I'm out of here. I've been a mess. I enjoyed this too much. Jason, happy New Year. I'll talk to you guys soon.
Bye-bye.
Okay, let's shift gears a little bit. That was fantastic. Right. I think everybody got a good sense of, look, the reality is we want people to gain from this. And there are all sorts of ways that people are going to gain from this show. When you're talking about an e-commerce business or direct-to-consumer, it's not just about how to sell products online. It's about how to live healthy, how to have a life that is rewarding, where you're giving back, and then ultimately where you have peace of mind, and you're able to do things that are meaningful. Let's go back to where we were a couple of minutes ago around Hue, and let's go from Hue to Human Code to where you are today.
Sure. So when Hue started to take off, I've always been the chairman. My wife and my brother-in-law were in the day-to-day operations. When Hue started to take off, you know, I think we realized collectively that we needed to, you know, really spend more time on the strategy and the focus of it. And around that time, I was deriving so much enjoyment from just the feedback we were getting from people. Like, you know, we got all sorts of great messages from people who were diabetic or who had autoimmune or who didn't think they could eat, you know, delicious things anymore. And I remember thinking, like, that was so much more satisfying and rewarding than like generating big returns, which, you know, that's what I had done for the last 15 years. And I started becoming an angel investor in the early, 2012, 13, 14 timeframe. In a lot of companies that had similar ethos or philosophy or mission of Hue. And in some cases I was advising entrepreneurs, and in other cases, you know, I was helping, and providing capital. And I just realized that, you know, that was an area where I had just such a good time. I felt like I had real, comparative advantages. And I felt like it was actually, you know, doing something for the planet and for people that was near and dear to my heart. And as that continued, and we had a lot of success with Hue, which has become quite a big company now, and we had a lot of success, I had a lot of success with many of my angel investments. And I just realized that I was sort of done with the hedge fund thing after 20 years. I had a great run. You know, my last couple of years were not great, but the first 15, 16 years were. And I sort of, you know, I wondered whether that was a function of the markets changing on me or just some internal compass telling me, like, you're done with this chapter. It's been 20 years, Jason. And I realized I wanted to build a company, you know, so Human Co. is actually the culmination of all this experience, where I wanted to build a company that was not a fund. It's a holding company. It was really modeled after a hybrid of, you know, I'll call it Berkshire Hathaway and Procter & Gamble or Mondelez. Mondelez actually bought a minority stake in Hue a couple years ago, and is now one of our partners. And I wanted to build a next generation company that that espoused and really stood for all the principles that we had been thinking about and I'd been thinking about for the last decade, and using the success of both my finance career as well as my investing in consumer products, and as well as my direct experience in, co-founding and helping lead Hue over the last decade, we felt like that there wasn't really anything out there that was like that. And HumanCo is really just the culmination of all of this. We are now taking what my family and I did with Hue, and we're doing that with other verticals that aren't snacking. You know, Hue is a clean snacking company, but I feel like in anything that's a consumer product or a consumable, there's a tremendous need still for helping people live healthier lives. And I think that there's a lot of categories for anything you put in your body or on your body, yep, where either the product isn't that healthy and it's still harming humanity, or it's harming the earth, or it just doesn't work very well. And I think that it's odd to me, but there's just not a lot of stuff out there that's both epic and clean at the same time. And so we created HumanCo to do just that as a singular company with the spirit of eventually taking it public.
It's fantastic. Jason, so for the audience, you obviously went through a series of events, as you mentioned, a number of issues from an autoimmune standpoint that hit you in an acute manner, and it caused you to have to change your behavior. And that gave you meaning and gave you purpose in terms of what you're doing now. And to your earlier point, I mean, you alluded to it. It's like there are people who have certain issues that they need to eat and healthy in order to suppress those challenges. And then there are other people who can actually get much better performance. And I'm not talking about performance as in like you're running or you're working out or whatever, but even mental performance and mental calm and acuity. Again, you went through something that gave you that that North Star and that purpose. For those that are listening, how can they find that for themselves? How can they find meaningful purpose without going through adversity?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I've been through a lot of introspection over the decades, and I don't think I've ever quite found exactly what my quote calling was, but I certainly know what my callings were not. And for me, what I tried to pay attention to is what are the things that you end up gravitating towards in your free time? What are the things that you just end up finding, you know, kind of gives you that little light in your brain when you see it, and it gives you sort of an excitement? You know, for some people it's sports, for some people it's music, for some people it's movies, for some people it's reading a good book, for some people it's a great conversation with someone interesting. You know, this idea of flow, you know, that's been sort of talked about now for the last 30, 40 years, is a measurable psychological state. And you have to be attuned to what are the things that really bring you joy, and what are the things that you can't quite put your finger on it, but you're like, I don't really like this. I would never do this in my free time. And for me, it was just about paying attention to all those little cues over a very long period of time. And for me, when I would get stressed or I would be in places that I think my body didn't want me to be, it would manifest physiologically as illness. And I'm kind of like a canary in the coal mine where everyone has this problem. You know, yeah, it is well understood that a lot of psychological issues manifest physiologically.
Sure.
And make you sick or make you, you know, develop ailments. And I think a lot of people just aren't attuned to the cues that you get daily and weekly about, like, why is this bothering you and why is it not?
Absolutely. I mean, that's, you talk about, I think it's a sensitivity. Some people, it shows up physiologically, and in many ways it's a blessing, because if you're able to physiologically respond to something, you're more aware of it. Then subconsciously, some places you go make you happy. Some scents make you happy. Some things make you sad, whatever. We're just not attuned to those on a general, on a regular basis. But I think that those things truly impact. I think Gary, said it best. It's like you're focused on what people are putting in their body, what they're putting on their body. Gary's focused on what they're putting here. And they're all sort, and then who you have around you and whatnot. I mean, there are all these facets that make you happy, make you feel fulfilled as an individual. Again, focus of the show is commerce, obviously, but I think that it's really important for us to think about these things. And as I've mentioned many times on the show, especially for those folks that aren't already in market, that are like, shit, I want to jump on this direct-to-consumer train. If you're going to spend the time, and I have conversations with people all the time. They reach out to me, friends, cousins, et cetera. I want to sell something online. Okay, great. What do you want to do? I'm thinking about this, that. I'm like, if you're going to do anything, if you're going to start with a blank canvas, start with something that you feel like improves people's lives and is positive for them. Why are you going to do the same thing somebody else is going to do that doesn't actually benefit? And I realize this is relative. We're talking about things that are relative conversations. It's not a good, bad, whatever, but it's more a matter of at least you feel like you're doing something positive. So shifting again further into commerce, and then we want to take audience questions. So drop in your questions, please, wherever you are in the comments, and we'll get to them. So direct to consumer, retail, how does an organization like Human & Co., how does a brand like you, how do you see the role of retail, direct to consumer, e-tailers, delivery service providers? How do you see these things now that kind of the COVID spike in e-commerce has occurred? We're several months past that. We're still sustaining levels. E-commerce isn't going anywhere. Consumers that have tried purchasing products online in many categories are going to stick to purchasing online. Where do you see all of this going moving forward?
Well, I think for the listeners, if they're interested in actually developing commerce, you know, I think it's important. And this is something I learned, you know, over my 21 year investment career you know, I've invested in and shorted literally thousands of companies over 20 years. And you learn a lot when you do that. And I think the most important thing with investing, which is one of the most competitive pursuits on the planet because of how many dollars are at stake and how easy it is to sort of play with the stock market, is that the most important thing that I think about with e-commerce is you first have to understand what game you're playing, and you have to understand how the game is different today than it was 5 years ago. And, you know, it's gotten easier for people in their dorm room to launch a product with Shopify and start selling it like in a week. It's gotten easier to do that than ever in our history. And that means that there is a proliferation, and I'm sure you see it on your social feeds, there's a proliferation of tons and tons and tons of shit and products, and this does this and this does that. And so you first have to know, like, I'm entering a game that is insanely competitive. Just like when I went into the stock market 21 years ago, I recognized even then it was insanely competitive, and today it's way more competitive. And so then you have to ask, what am I doing that's different? And what am I providing that is unique? And why is somebody going to want my thing over the thousands of other things that are just like it? And I think you have to be humble about that, because there are so many choices and there are so many options. And, you know, for me, you know, and by the way, I went into chocolate with my brother-in-law and my wife 10 years ago without thinking about it as like a true business. Because had I walked through the Whole Foods aisles or any grocery store and you literally see 100 brands of chocolate, my investment mind would have flashed like red flag, like, don't do it. And so I think contextualizing what it is that you're doing differently is probably the first important step. I think as a consumer, and I always try to look at things as an investor and a consumer, as a consumer, I am overwhelmed with the options I see online. I'm overwhelmed with how many different like clean cookware options there are. And I'm overwhelmed with how many keto cookies there are. And I'm overwhelmed with how many like, you know, keto bars and protein powders and, you know, liquid IV copycats. And I don't even know where to start. And so I think the first question is, how do you shine amidst the noise?
Yep.
And what are you going to do to shine? And I think personally, I think the pendulum has swung where 5-6 years ago, if you, or when we did this 8-10 years ago, this was highly unique. Nobody was doing clean chocolate, and certainly nobody was doing clean chocolate that tasted good.
Yep.
And what I think my family and I did well with that, which was mostly intentional, but a lot of it was luck, was we said, you know what? We're not going to play the venture capital game of just grow revenue at any price, splatter it everywhere, you know, try to generate revenue and then hope somebody pays us a multiple of revenue. We wanted to build true brand equity.
Yep.
And I think there is a lack today of true brand equity for a lot of companies. And the reason I think that is because we have evolved in terms of e-commerce so much towards what you can measure is what you need to bet on. So CAC, LTV, ROAS, these are all measurable things. So let's just spend all of our time on that, which, you know, 5 years ago was the genius move. But today, everyone's so myopically focused on just those variables that what I fear with a lot of these brands is when they turn off their marketing spigot and the customer has 100 other choices of keto cookie to choose from, they're not going to remember your brand.
Yep.
And they only used your brand because you kept bombarding them with ads. And so I think what worked for the previous 100 years of consumer products prior to, call it 10 years ago, is probably right, which is that you need to build real brand equity. And building real brand equity takes time. It takes authenticity. It's slower. But at the end of the day, you know, when you stop advertising as much as you think you need to, you want people to remember like, oh, I love that brand. And I know what that brand stands for. And I know the people behind that brand. And when shit hits the fan and I sort of remember like what kept me comfort during COVID, there are a lot of people who are going to say, I was baking healthy items with Huge M's. And they'll remember that in 20 years. And like, that's not because we blasted them with high ROAS ads.
Yep.
That's because we have a real authentic mission behind what we're doing. And I think that this cohort that's on this call needs to really think about what is it going to take to build a lasting brand.
Brilliant. And I think that one of the things that we need to think about, and you touched on it, but the meaning and the authenticity behind what you're doing is ultimately the brand that you're building. And turning that spigot off is a great way of putting it, because so many brands, they survive on advertising. You turn that off, nobody knows who they are. And the reality is because they don't stand for something in the consumer's psyche. And it's not a matter of just pounding them with messaging, but things that are meaningful, things that make them think, things that are provocative, and things that they can get behind. I think that, again, to your point, even 5 years ago, it was a lot easier because there weren't as many brands advertising on Facebook, Instagram, et cetera. So they're going straight after ROAS. Now that's become difficult as well, because you can't actually just go there and say, I'm just going to start selling products and making money, unless your objective, to your point, is just to inflate revenue and exit. But then you're not really building a business. And if you want to build a sustainable business, you have to do something that will be effective in the long run and isn't just a matter of playing an arbitrage game of CAC and ROAS. Another question for you, Jason, and then we'll get to the audience. You talk about early on, and I think this is a really interesting thing I want to discuss here. Early on, you didn't walk the aisles of Whole Foods to see what the competitive set was, what their ingredients were, what their branding was, how you were going to do it differently, so on and so forth. While in your day job as a hedge fund, you were assessing these things daily, right? But when it came to your passion project, you did what you thought was right. But now you're looking at companies all the time for Human Co. You're launching new brands, et cetera. So what is it from back then that you still do today? And now having been in the game long enough and being as successful as you are in it, what is it that you do now when you think about a new category or you're thinking about a new product? either for acquisition or to develop a new product. How do you actually effectively assess what's out there and not let it dissuade you from getting into it?
Well, just to be clear, I did actually know the competitive set when we created our chocolate. We created our chocolate more as a passion.
Sure.
And what I was saying is, if I was creating that chocolate with my brother-in-law just to make money and just as an investment, we would never have done it.
Got it.
We did it because we felt there was a need and that most of the healthy chocolate out there sucked and that most of the chocolate that tasted good had a lot of crap in it.
Yep.
So it wasn't, you know, I was trying to get more at, you know, when you approach a problem, it can't just be about the money, you know, because you'll end up never having enough energy to pursue it and continue with it. Because ultimately, I have infinite energy in things that I naturally just love doing. I don't have to think about like motivating, like it's just how I am. And if you try to do things just for money, you will always lose because that intrinsic motivation isn't there. And eventually, when you make enough money, it stops. So what we look for is in terms of like very specific, we look for categories where it's a big market, mm-hmm. Where the incumbents or the kind of market leaders are still pretty gross. We use the word gross. And we look for areas where we think we won't have a lot of what I call performance degradation with a cleaner label. And I'll give you an example. So there's a reason you don't see many super healthy, clean bug sprays. You don't see them because they don't work. And so those have severe performance degradation when you try to use really healthy stuff that isn't sort of chemically or slightly toxic. They just don't work because ultimately, you know, you're killing bugs or you're trying to deter them at a minimum. And so we spent a lot of time on healthy bug sprays and we ultimately passed because we didn't feel like we could do it with the quality of ingredients that are up to the Human Co standard. And then it also be effective. Chocolate, by contrast, which was sort of my first foray into this, you know, with my family, if you taste your chocolate, you'll notice that that's as good as any chocolate you've ever had for dark chocolate. And we have literally thousands of people who say it's the best chocolate they've ever had, and irrespective of whether it's healthy or not. And so that's an example of something without performance degradation. If you try, we just bought control of a company called Coconut Bliss for Human Co. It's a plant-based, 100% organic, sustainable-focused ice cream. Most plant-based ice creams that I have come across, you know you're not eating ice cream. And it's very obvious. Coconut Bliss, which we're going to continue to improve and slightly reformulate and come out with new flavors, but Coconut Bliss was always one of my favorites because it doesn't feel like you're sacrificing. And it's organic, and it's plant-based, and it's sustainable. And so we look for areas where we think you can accomplish something without degradation. We also want to focus on areas, and this is controversial, but it's just an investment view for us. We also want to focus on areas where there's a what we call a high replenishment rate. There's certain products that have high loyalty, think of like toothpaste, but have low replenishment rate. Where at least for me, I don't know for other people, but yeah, a tube of toothpaste lasts me like over a month, maybe 2 months. So I'm only interacting with that brand 5-6 times a year.
Yeah.
And that's not a lot. Whereas, you know, in things like Coconut Bliss or Hue Chocolate or some of the other brands that we're working on right now, there's much more interaction with the products. And for us, again, this is a preference, but for us, that's an important attribute. I, you know, and this is sort of ironic, most of the things that I've focused on have not been particularly DTC or e-com friendly. and that's partially by design, but it's partially just because I gravitated towards things that are refrigerated or frozen. And, you know, in an odd way, you know, I think things that are harder to do are less competitive because by definition, they're harder to do. So those are just sort of a sampling of kind of the things that we look for.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I think that the point about replenishment isn't a controversial one. It's a business one, right? I mean, yeah. And for those that are listening, they hear all the time about things like subscription and whatnot. And it's not just a matter of what is a subscription model, but how often is this product going to get replenished? And then what category is it in? Where there's brand affinity and they're going to stick with you. All right. So this has been a fantastic conversation. Let's jump to a few questions. Dustin, do your thing. So this first one comes in from XX Daisy XX, Jason H. Carr. What is some management advice you can give me? I work at a Dairy Queen as a manager and I want my team to feel the same way about work like I do. I want to be the best leader. Great question.
Ooh, it's great. And it's you know, this one's an interesting one, Daisy, because I've done some jobs that, you know, there's certain types of jobs that are more naturally fulfilling than others. And I've definitely done some jobs over the years that are not naturally fulfilling. And I think, you know, when you're a manager, there's elements of being a manager that are fulfilling because you're training people, you're leading people, you're seeing progress. But if they're below you and they're not managing people, they have to find fulfillment and purpose. And what I've learned is that fulfillment and purpose are necessary for anyone to have enjoyment in whatever they do. And money does not accomplish fulfillment and purpose. And so it could be just finding small tasks, finding small things in their daily habits that they can take satisfaction and that they can see progress in. Humans need to see progress. They need to see fulfillment and they need to see purpose. And if those are all missing, you can't be really happy and your morale will be terrible. So I would suggest you find in what they do, and some people gamify, you know, menial tasks sometimes, you know, like checking the cash register or filling out forms or cleaning the bathroom. You know, there's all sorts of things that you can do where you could provide pride and fulfillment for doing a job well done. And I think you as a manager have to think about what it is that if you interview each one of them and you ask them, what is it in your day that you actually like doing? And tell me a time when you were happy. And then taking that information and then optimizing on that so that you can, you know, whatever task they're doing, you can try to make it more purpose-driven.
Absolutely. There's a reason why they say how you do one thing is how you do everything. And for people, when that rings true to you and you realize that the effort that you put into one thing is how you basically what output you get and how you feel about yourself is going to be about everything else you do. To Jason's point, finding those little wins and seeing how it makes you feel about yourself, that positive reinforcement should continue. Next question comes in. I'm starting a seafood delivery business. Fresh, live, sustainable, traceable seafood from the Canadian East Coast, the mountains in Banff and Canmore, et cetera. We'll be doing B2B, but heavily on B2C. So presumably the question here, even though it's not a question, it's a statement. Congratulations to you is the answer to that. But the question here then, you talk about frozen foods. Let's talk about seafood for a moment. What are your thoughts around the entire seafood sector or frozen food?
So I love frozen food as a category. I think, you know, I'm very much against preservatives and chemicals to prolong shelf life. You know, frozen is the oldest and best technology that we have still to this day for preserving food. And it's also the cleanest and the safest.
That's what I was going to say.
And yeah. It also maintains the highest density of nutrients. So I'm a huge fan of frozen. I love seafood. Seafood, you know, in most periods, non-COVID is the bulk of the meat animal products I tend to eat. And I'm a huge proponent and supporter of wild seafood. There's a great company, I believe it's based in Canada, called Vital Choice, that I've been a customer of for probably 15 years. And my family buys a lot of wild Alaskan salmon and a lot of other wild fish. So, I love it. I think the challenge for most people with wild or sustainably raised seafood is it's expensive. And I think convincing people as to the merits of why it should be expensive is a challenge. But people need to realize that catching a fish with a pole and then shipping it and so that it's preserved is not a cheap endeavor.
Yep.
So I'm a huge fan of that.
Fantastic. Chef Lizette asks us, should you cut off the marketing well at some point just to test and measure your brand worth? So do your
I love that. So when we've looked at companies to invest in, and I see a very high kind of DTC success rate, and I see a high spend. You know, one of the things which I've not been able to accomplish, by the way, but one of the things I've always wanted to do as part of the due diligence is force them to shut off the spending for a month and see what happens. I think if you have control of that and you're not worried about what happens and you don't have shareholders that you have to explain that to, I think it's a fabulous exercise. Because you know, there's only so many ways to measure it. Yeah. And that is a true way to measure. Do people remember your brand when you stop telling them about it?
Yeah. And I think there are other kind of micro ways of doing that. It's not gonna have as massive amount of impact as what Jason's talking about here in terms of just shutting it off. But the other way of doing that is just to understand what percentage of your sales are referral sales. So someone's right. Actually mentioned to them. So non-attributable to advertising. I know attribution is a whole situation. We don't need to get in that right now. We don't have the time to, but non-attributable ways. Are people sharing it with their friends, et cetera? And is that how people are coming in? Jason, we've taken quite a bit of your time today. Let's have one more question if that's okay. And then to Gary's point, we got to get you on for a longer period of time. So
next question.
So while Dustin's pulling it up, what's your opinion of retirement with the expansion of the gig economy? And then we have one more question after this.
Okay. So I think I know what this question is getting at. I don't think I'm ever going to, you know, conventionally retire. But I'll definitely continue to change, you know, the phases of my life and how involved I am in various things and you know, thinking about kind of my own energy levels as I age. You know, but there's a lot of literature on people truly retiring, you know, particularly people who are in sort of, you know, public service where they get a pension and they actually have to retire. Policemen, firemen, those types. And there's a very high incidence of depression and a very high incidence of just like mental malaise. Because again, getting to my earlier point on purpose and fulfillment, people need purpose and they need to have things that they're always working towards, even if it's not a huge proportion of their day. You know, my father, who technically retired 6-7 years ago, he volunteers at a hospital and works mostly with people who are dying because he just likes interacting with them. And he likes providing sort of a friendly face and being able to talk to them. He doesn't get paid for it, but it provides him fulfillment. And so I think retirement is sort of the death of your mind. And I would say that you could definitely, I technically retired from the hedge fund industry,
yeah.
But I'm not retired. You know, I was done with that chapter. I spent, you know, every ounce of energy I had on that chapter. And now I wanted to focus on something else. So I would say, I don't think retirement is a healthy thing to do. I think always having a focus in an area that brings you fulfillment, even if it means no money. So you could financially retire, but I always think you should be mentally engaged.
And put it differently, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's an interesting concept you're bringing up, which is taking retirement and breaking it up and not thinking about retirement as a whole, but rather you might be financially fine to retire or you might be fine from another aspect, but to continue giving, continue to use your brain and continue to feel fulfilled.
Okay.
Final question. Julian E.R. Bill asks, what are your opinions on live stream experiential e-commerce? Let me share mine, Jason, and then I'd love to have your opinion on this.
I've never experienced this, so I'm curious. I don't even know if I can answer it.
and let's hope I can answer it as well. So here's the way I see this. Retail, for however many years, everybody's been saying retail needs to be more like digital. We got to get retail more like online. But the reality is there's a lot of ways that the online experience can be more like retail. So when you're asking this question, what comes to mind immediately for me are the smart and savvy brands that had retail employees that were able to, when retail was closed, take those retail employees, make them available as online stylists, online advisors, et cetera, that somebody could book for 15 to 30 minutes and interact with online on the site. So taking that real world experience and bringing it to the site so that I'm shopping, for example, a fashion site, and I want to figure out what to do, or a beauty site, et cetera. That brand had a bunch of people in retail that if you had gone into a Nordstrom, Macy's, et cetera, they would have talked to you. Now take those people, make them accessible online so that I can book them for 15 minutes and they can help me with makeup tips.
Got it.
That to me is one way of answering
this. Yeah, look, I think there is a great need, even though I haven't experienced this per se.
Yeah.
I am a big fan of experiential marketing. I am a big fan of experiences that involve more of your senses and engage you more as a person, because those are more memorable. And I do think that there are, especially with COVID and the rise of all of this digital activity, I think there's a lot of things that are still lacking. You know, whether it's interaction with a salesperson, whether it's being able to sort of see what stuff looks like on you. And I know that, you know, augmented reality is trying to do some of that, where you could sort of try stuff on. But I think there's elements of shopping that will never be able to be truly replicated through digital. But I do think we need to think about more and more ways to make it feel fun and interactive. Even like, you know, browsing for books, and I'm a huge book fan and I love to read, but like even now, like 20 years in from, you know, when Amazon first started selling books online, or 25 years, like I still like going into a bookshop and looking at, you know, the whole row and sort of pulling it out and flipping through it. And I find that very pleasurable relative to like scrolling on an Amazon feed. So I think it's definitely the future. I haven't experienced what you're talking about, but the idea definitely resonates with me.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your energy here, I think the reality is there will always be a place for physical retail. It's just a matter of retail giving consumers value and not just existing because that's the only place people can go buy something.
That's right. Curation and value and experience for sure.
Absolutely. Jason, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for your time, and I'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. And I'm sure the audience got a lot. I know there are a ton of questions we didn't get to, so please tweet at us. At Jason, at me, at Gary, and we'll get to you as soon as we can. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, guys. Thank you.
See ya.
All right, episode's over. Please leave a review and subscribe up on Apple. It would mean a lot to me. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gary. Today's highlighted review is Wow, Great Variety and Always on Point by Patrick OFCA. I've listened to this podcast for a while and have just been guilted into leaving a review. With great variety and awesome guests, there's something for everyone. By the way, Zubin is a beast. Awesome e-com insights. Keep it up, Team Gary V. Cheers. Thanks, Patrick. Keep those reviews coming. We could highlight yours next.